when the shift boss hits that button, then you'd better look alive, 'cause the lumber comes a-rolling like the bees out of a hive. And you'll feel that sweat come pouring as each muscle screams with pain. And you'll wonder if it's worth it working on the long green chain.
Hi, I'm Mark Laren Young, and this is the Green Chain Podcast. Oliver Hodge is a props master turned filmmaker who chronicled the story of rebel architect Michael Reynolds for the amazing movie Garbage Warrior. Reynolds makes houses out of almost everything but trees, and he builds them in disaster areas around the world. The movie just played the Vancouver International Film Festival, where it won the People's Choice Award for Most Popular International Documentary. I talked to Oliver in Vancouver about recycled houses, saving the forest, and making the ultimate lightsaber.
All right, so start off, tell everybody about Garbage Warrior.
Garbage Warrior, it's a feature documentary covering the life story of Maverick eco-architect Michael Reynolds, who's been struggling to build radically sustainable communities in the deserts in New Mexico. And the story really follows his struggle with bureaucracy and the legislators on how to get his communities to evolve and be able to test new ideas without getting into trouble. So it's really a narrative of one man's battle or fight to make the world a greener place.
Now, I'm assuming you started this before he was traveling to India, before Hurricane Katrina, for Rita. I mean,
yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about how he was basically pulled into these devastated zones and building his stuff out of garbage?
Well, every time there's a disaster, he gets asked to go somewhere. I mean, after the earthquake in Pakistan, they got a request to go there. They got a request after Hurricane Mitch. They've done a few projects around the world after disasters or earthquakes, and the buildings are good for us. They're earthquake-proof to a degree because the tires just slip and they're made of rubber. So they just move around with the earthquake, and the building's left completely intact. So people like the designs for disasters.
You've got to tell people what these buildings are made out of, because it's astonishing to me what these buildings are made out of.
The buildings are passive solar constructions that are made out of used materials, like car tires, beer cans, beer bottles, the sides of washing machines. But they're all beautifully placed and rendered over with adobe, and the bottles are made a feature of, like stained glass, and the cans are made a feature of sometimes. And the buildings are actually very beautiful inside, and kind of Mexican-y looking adobe kind of finishes, and artwork and all that kind of painting and finishing, but with lots of plants. The water's recycled four times within the building. You've got two planter systems that clean the grey water from your sink and your shower. You've got a black water system in the greenhouse that filters all the sewage from your toilet, and the captured water from the roof is drinkable water. It's filtered and then it goes through these planters, and the water's actually used within the building to do your washing up, to grow your food in the kitchen. Then it flushes the toilet, which is another use, and then it goes through a black water system that grows more food, and that cleans it for the last time. So you're really living in a kind of biosphere, and there's loads of little pumps that go off, boat pumps and servos and switches, and, you know, if you do anything in the house, it reacts to you. So, you know, you go to the toilet or you have a shower and you can hear, it's not too loud, but you can hear all these little pumps going off and pumping the water into another tank. And, you know, the building's like a machine, and it kind of lives and breathes with you.
And it retains heat. I mean,
it retains heat. The tires, the back wall of the building is very, very thick. It's about 10, 15 foot thick in places. It's rammed earth car tires rammed with earth and built like bricks in a U shape around the side and the back wall of the house. That's the retaining walls. And then those tire walls are bermed up with soil right up to the top with a very, very thick berm, about 15 foot. That berm is also insulated in the middle as well with whatever insulation they can use. Sometimes it's styrofoam, not particularly eco material, but the main thing is to get the building to run on zero or very, very low carbon. To have a utility bill of about $40 a year is what they're aiming for. So if they have to use a few unsustainable materials, you know, to get there, it's better that the building works for 1,000 years on very, very low energy than to try and make everything out of sustainable materials. Obviously, they will replace the materials with better materials when they're available and cost-effective or whatever. But so that's generally the buildings. The sun comes through the windows at the front. You've got glass all the way along the south. They're always facing south, these buildings. They've got to be facing south in this climate. And the sun, the low winter sun comes through the windows and heats up the back wall. Or the summer sun. The summer sun doesn't. The summer sun's deflected off. But any even light or just people being in there will give it heat. Very, you know, it'll slowly heat up, and it takes about a year to heat up properly. But that once you've got your building at its mean temperature, it'll hold it for a long, long time. So that's basically how the buildings work. The wall at the back is a third of the volume of the interior of the building, and it stores heat. It basically averages out the mean temperature of the building. So when you get a chronic temperature drop, the wall will stay warm, and that'll radiate out heat into the house. So, and it does work, because I've been there in buildings in the middle of the night, in the winter, minus 30 degrees outside. I went out for a cigarette, couldn't even smoke the whole cigarette, it was so cold. I went back inside, and I was down to a T-shirt within 10 minutes. So it was around about 68 degrees Fahrenheit inside, and it was minus 30 outside.
Now, you met him when he was building one of these homes in Brighton, right?
Yeah, I met Mike in my hometown of Brighton, and was immediately struck by his energy and charisma, and just watching the man work. He's an architect, and he's in the trenches with his crew, swinging a sledgehammer and covered in dirt. And he's got that kind of mentality. He's a real frontline leader of men, and well, not just men. They've got women and all sorts of other nationalities that work with them, actually, in New Mexico. So there's all sorts of people that work with him. But he's a real leader, and he works alongside his crew. He gets paid the same as them, but he does run the company. And I just thought he was a great character, and what he was doing is really cutting edge as well. So you put the two together and you've definitely got a good story.
What year was that that you met?
I met him in 2003, in the spring of 2003. He came over to work with a British crew, and they were constructing a demonstration home. He was only in England for 2 weeks, but when I looked at the rushes or the footage of his interviews, I realised there was a story there. He told me that he'd nearly been put in jail and lost his architect's licence, and got his communities were shut down. And I'm thinking, well, that sounds interesting, you know.
What was your original project?
Well, the original project was to go and film the English project, the build. But it was just another sort of TV episode, really. It wasn't. It was just like an architectural episode. And we've already got stuff on British TV that's very similar, so I would have been competing with that. And broadcasters kind of told me that they wouldn't take it. And so I had to try and find... I mean, I was going to do a short piece on the New Mexico side of things, but it ended up being all of that and none of the English. I cut the English out completely out of the story.
And was that going to be your first attempt at filmmaking, that original piece? Or had you made anything else?
No, it was my first attempt at filmmaking. Yeah, I'd never made a film before. I've been working in the film industry as a prop model maker and model designer on feature films.
On really cool feature films.
Yeah, on...
Sorry, as a geek, when you list off... Can you list off something?
I'll give you a few. Star Wars, The Phantom Menace, Bond films, Die Another Day, Tomb Raider 1 and 2, The Fifth Element, Luke Besson sci-fi film. That was a classic.
Yeah,
I've done some real crazy ones.
Sounds like you've made the kind of props that people are paying $1 billion for on eBay and that are in the sci-fi museum.
Yeah, I made the lightsabers for the... I actually personally made the lightsabers for The Phantom Menace. So
that's really
that's
cool.
My claim to fame before I was doing this.
Okay. All right, so how did you get out of making lightsabers into making movies?
I was worn out with the... I'd done 12 years on features, almost back-to-back. I'd done 21 films in 12 years or something. And you know, you're up at 5:30 every morning. You don't get back till 8:30 at night, you know, because especially when they're shooting and you're having to stand by and look after the shooting crew and deal with any problems. And it kind of wears you out. And I was like, do I want to stop working or do I want to maybe put the same amount of energy into my own movie and just try it? You know, and I was already getting interested. I already bought a camera. I was already getting interested in doing something. I was doing little projects on weekends and just filming things. But my passion has been, I've been trying to recycle my waste in the film industry. That's why I'm slightly jaded about the film industry, because I've been fighting against, banging my head against a brick wall for years trying to recycle stuff and get them to be aware environmentally on Hollywood movies, and it's not easy, you know, because it's just, it's the last thing they want to deal with, and it's going to cost them money, you know. Yeah. But I did make them pay for it in the end. But I'm passionate about the environment, always have been. I've been concerned for the, at least 15 years before I started this project. I read an article, a 10-page article in a Sunday magazine in England, and it was saying how the planet's falling apart and the human race is destroying pretty much everything, and we're heading towards a complete environmental breakdown. So I was inspired to maybe film something with my newfound energy and my camera that was something environmental. So it was only a matter of time before I met someone like Mike. I mean, it just had to be Mike. It was kind of fate and destiny in a way, because... Yeah. I can't think of anyone else on the planet that's kind of quite like him, really, in terms of his attitude. He's just kind of, he's like, you know, he's just an unstoppable force, you know. I was just lucky enough to, I mean, obviously I found out about the British project and I followed, you know, I tracked them down and I found the project organiser. My girlfriend told me about the project, and I already knew about Earthships, and I tracked the project organiser down in a pub and said, I want to shoot your project. And he's going, oh, we've already got someone interested and whatever. And this went on for 2 or 3 weeks. The project hadn't started. And I phoned him up, and they were going to start digging or something the next day, before Mike got there. And I said, right, where's this film crew? And he said, oh, well, I said, well, look, yeah, they haven't done, they've bottled out, haven't they? Or they haven't, you haven't got it together. He goes, no. So I said, well, I'll be there tomorrow with the camera.
Nice.
And, you know, so that was me in. I got my inroad there. And then the next week, he said he was wanting to time-lapse the whole build. And he was working out how to do it. And he couldn't work out how to do it. So I turned up the next week, and I'd welded that back in my workshop on the Bond film, I think I was working on Die Another Day. I welded a 21-foot time-lapse tripod tower. So you're getting some sound bites there. I welded a 21-foot pyramid in three pieces that bolted together with a special clamp for clamping a camera on for the next 9 months, and I had a waterproof case for it. And I turned up in my van with this thing on top of my van, this 21-foot tower, pulled up outside the pub, and the guy goes, what the hell's that, bloody hell? And he was just inspired that I'd put that much energy into the idea, and I'd just completely cured the time-lapse problem. And we put that camera up every day for 6 months, 7 months, and we've got a complete time lapse of the whole Earthship being built, from the first tire to the last pane of glass going in from that. So
that's incredible.
Yeah, so I was in with those guys definitely for doing that, and then obviously I got in with Mike through them, and you know, I was just inspired when I met him. Especially when I went out to New Mexico. I went out to New Mexico that same year with a crew. At that point, I had a cameraman, and I was shooting myself, and we shot for a couple of weeks. And then I ran out of money, and I was on my own. He taught me how to use my camera better than I knew already.
Oh, wow.
My sister was a sound engineer. She taught me some stuff about sound. And then for the next 2.5, 3 years or whatever, I was on my own. So I just shot the whole thing myself after that. And took a gamble that I would be able to do it okay.
Where did you join him? Where you were in New Mexico, and where else did you go? Were you in?
Well, I went out to New Mexico quite a few times to get various court cases, get the shot of them getting the little court case where they won their land back after 7 years. I was working on Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, I think, and I kind of bolted off one weekend and got a couple of days' footage out there in New Mexico. And then at the end of that year, I'd said to Mike earlier in the year, look, I'm worried about the story. I've got no observational action. You're going to rewrite the law. I'm not going to come back until you're ready to try and change the law. Because he said, I've already rewritten the law once, and they threw it out 7 years ago. I'm going to do it again. And I said, that sounds like good to film. You know, that would be great to film. I said, tell you what, phone me back when you're going to do that, because that's what I want. I want some action. I want some drama. And then 6 months later, he called me back and he said, right, we're going in January. I said, okay, I'll be there. I'll be there with a camera. So I was there with him all the way. And actually, it was a hell of a lot better for him to have me there, because it's not much fun going around a legislator for 2 months every day on your own. So we were a kind of double act, you know, and we kept each other company. And you know, he had someone to moan to about. And it was great because I got it all on camera. So
it also occurs to me that, I mean, it's, you know, what is it, Heisenberg principle? The fact that you were filming this, I think, is also going to make the legislators a little more aware that people are watching them. You know, I mean, if he walks into the office alone, don't you think it has some impact that you're behind him with the camera? Don't you think that makes it a little more...
If who walks into the office?
If Mike walks into an office and he's got you and you're standing there with the camera, I would think they're a little more reluctant to just casually toss him out of the door.
They were. It did make a difference, actually. It didn't in the long run. It made a difference to how people were. They were very careful what they said, because there was some other stuff going on that I just couldn't get in the story, because no one really said it in front of camera. They wouldn't have dared. Okay. But what it was they wanted to take the word sustainable out of the bill and use it. There was a few people there that were from the areas of New Mexico where there was a lot of mining and oil industries and all that kind of stuff. And they were really frustrated with the Environment Agency for clamping down on what they could do. So they saw Mike's bill as a ticket to being able to do what the hell they want with some really dodgy industries.
Oh.
And Mike's bill could have even... They could have had the worst possible negative effect that he wanted it to, because it could have meant the feds came down and abused it as well and started testing weapons again and all that kind of stuff.
And
called it experimental, because they wanted to take the word sustainable out of the bill. There was about three senators that wanted to take it out. And the Environment Agency went berserk, and Mike was, you know, of course, you know, but the way they said it was so carefully worded, it just didn't stand up as strong enough. It would have lost the audience, and it was the whole Senate thing was so complicated anyway that we really had to simplify it in the edit, in order for people to understand. You've got to get through one committee, then another few committees, then onto the floor and pass. That was the deal. That's the way we portrayed it. The reality of it was we had to get through, I mean, nine committees on each side. You had the Senate side and the House of Representatives. You've got two floors in the legislature. But for the audience to have to deal with that would have been too complicated.
So we
simplified it.
Were you present for the build in India?
Yeah, I shot that, yeah. Yeah, I shot the tsunami stuff, yeah.
What was it like being there and just personally, never mind the filmmaking aspect?
It was horrific to arrive there reasonably recently after it happened. I went round to the local people while the guys were working, and I heard some horrific stories from people that were still kind of traumatised, really. It was the Forgotten Island, Little Andaman Island. The government didn't help them. All the choppers were going over and helping the Nicobar Islands. No one dropped any food parcels on the Little Andaman Island for quite some time. There was dead bodies rotting for over a month after the tsunami happened. And there was, you know, I mean, the dogs went feral and started attacking people because they'd been eating the dead. And it was horrendous. They had to shoot the dogs. And there were sea crocodiles coming up and eating people, you know. So when we first got there, when we were camping very close to the beach, and we were all living in tents, and in the middle of the night, I slept with a knife under my pillow the first night because I heard about these sea crocodiles eating people, and sure enough, in the middle of the night, there was this big thing creeping around the outside of my tent, and everyone, it was the same for everyone, and I was like, oh my God, you know, what do we do? And in the end, we all got the courage to pop our heads out. And there was a herd of cows because everywhere in India, the cows are everywhere. Yeah. And they were kind of brushing up against our tents and kind of lying down next to our tents, and we could kind of hear them breathing and stuff. And in fact, in the film, you'll see a shot of a cow by the tents when Mike's getting up in the morning. So, but it was horrible hearing people's, you know, recounting what happened. And, you know, we were really the first kind of camera people or anyone to pay them any attention to that island. So I was getting some stories from people that were pretty horrific. And it was sad, really sad being there. But they're amazing people and they're incredibly resilient. And they were just getting on with their lives and trying to rebuild, you know. And they were living in squalid conditions in the relief camps, you know. And their future wasn't looking all that good.
It was interesting because I thought your approach to that island was incredibly restrained. I kept thinking, if this was American TV news, it would be disaster porn. And they would have been showing people, I didn't feel you, the fact that you sort of handled almost all of that disaster with that incredibly upbeat man who had lost everybody, and you saw, I got the impression he was about to cry and you cut away before he did. And I thought that was just lovely.
Yeah, I don't want to start cutting in people. I mean, you know, knew he was upset. And I wanted to be respectful to him. I like him. He's a friend. We email each other all the time. And I'm going to go back out and see him. You've got to give people a little bit of respect. I think, you know, he wanted to get on and do some stuff. That's why he was involved with the project. You know, he wanted to, you know, he didn't want to. They don't sit around moping, those guys. You know, they don't feel sorry for themselves. They say there's no such thing as orphans on this island. You know, they're just children without parents. They're all of our children. They got that attitude, you know. So they had a big festival to cheer everyone up. The NGOs that were there had organised a festival, and we all went to that, and the local people were there, and you know, it was just amazing considering what they've been through. So the other thing was, I didn't want to move too far away from the story, you know, because the tsunami could have been a real bad side trip, you know. We could have wandered into so we had to cut it in a way that kept to the story, is that the, you know, it's proving that these buildings are better accepted after people have lost all their utilities, and you know, and to prove that that they work, you know, anywhere as well, you know. So
what hit me watching this, have you heard anything about Naomi Klein's new book, The Shock Doctrine?
No.
Oh, okay. But she's got a new book out called The Shock Doctrine about disaster capitalism and how the world keeps changing in negative ways because basically think tanks have come up with whatever they want to do, you know, in terms of erasing communities or whatever. In terms of how, say, Katrina was handled, as opposed to how it would have been handled if Mike had gone in. And and this made me think of exactly that this was the shock doctrine in action, but in a positive way. This was Mike being prepared to walk in and do something positive that was only accepted because there was a disaster going on.
Yeah, I mean, it's great that we all did that trip and that he instigated it. And, you know, just to, for someone to just get their crew together, get on a plane, fly out the sledgehammers, you know, they all packs of stuff. They just took it all with them and did it. There was no farting around. There was no bureaucracy. He just said, we're going. I'm borrowing $35,000 from the bank and we're going. And that's it. And next thing we knew, we were all there. It was that quick. I mean, it took a while to get visas, but it wasn't, you know, some big company or NGO or whatever. We just went there. And that was a problem when we got there because, you know, the local architect and that guy turned up with 10 Americans on an island, and suddenly the FBI is onto us, so the equivalent of the FBI out there, and he pulls the architect into his office on the islands and just interrogates him for 2.5 hours, saying, you know, why are you bringing 10 Americans onto our island, you know, in the middle of a disaster? What are they doing, running guns or drugs or, you know? And he says, no, they're a bunch of sustainable house builders and we want to build an eco home to show these people that, you know, that they don't need to rely on wells next time there's a tsunami. They can just empty out the seawater from the catch water tank and refill it until the next rain comes. And they've got fresh water within, you know, a few weeks rather than having to truck it in from the government. So so that was what were we talking about? I was sidetracking there. What was the question?
I think we're fine with that. Now, was there anything?
Yeah, it was just the fact that he just, you know, it just happened. There was no, you know, no NGOs involved. All the rest of it, it just happened, and that was great to just, you know, if you want something doing, do it yourself. Sometimes that attitude's good, and Mike's got that attitude, you know.
Was there anything particular beyond the article? Was there like a moment, something that hit you? Was there something that happened in your hometown that made you so interested in environmentalism? Was there, or was it just finding out more about the world?
Well, I was brought up on a farm, and I had a very natural childhood in terms of, you know, I was quite in touch with nature, and coming from a farming family, I was always interested in art more than farming, and farming wasn't looking too good. I ended up in art college in London, and that was a shock, going into London after, you know, and being right in the middle of the city. And I started to feel that something wasn't right, and I wrote my thesis on psychic disintegration or alienation, and it's about how modern culture is alienated from their daily existence, and we're consciously in a bad state, really, as a culture. We're in a pretty bad state psychologically compared to our forefathers and tribes and all of that kind of more subconscious kind of existence. And the alchemists in the Middle Ages tried to put it right, and Carl Jung did a great study on that and showed what they were really about. They weren't trying to turn lead into gold. They were trying to find the gold in their soul, you know, which was actually, everything they did was a metaphor for that. So I was into the psychology of our modern culture and how badly, you know, the drugs, TV and alcohol and temazepam or whatever it is these people have to use for depression is the essential lubricating oil for the industrial Western culture. That is a problem. And our normality is actually a collective madness. We're out of control, you know, and we're heading for big trouble. And that was kind of what inspired me, because here are these guys, they're not a corporate, they're not part of any government, they're not being funded by anyone, and they've taken it upon themselves to make a very, very beautiful place to live. And the houses are just so natural when you're in them, that there's no sharp corners, it's feminine shapes, you've got plants everywhere, and that psychic disintegration or that alienation that people in cities experience by just looking at concrete and square corners all the time and having to do stressful work hours and all the rest of it, you know, they're one step towards getting rid of that stress and having no utility bills. There's another load of stress gone out of your life, besides the fact that you can create your own politics when you don't have to pay your bills, because you don't have to vote for who's going to distribute the local money and for the utilities and all that kind of stuff. So there was they'd empowered themselves and they'd changed the environment to, and I could just see the potential of what, you know, if this was taken on, not exactly tire for tire, can for can, bottle for bottle, but if these principles were adapted and proper town planners got involved in building new cities, including farms and land and acreages where we could develop local economies, we would improve as a race of people. We may get out of the trouble that we're heading for. You know, it's just what they're proposing is way beyond architecture. It's way beyond just being an eco, you know, liver or whatever. I mean, they're certainly not sandal-wearing, cardigan, raw food-eating. They're a bunch of beer-drinking scallywags from New Mexico. But they're passionate about the way they live, you know, their houses. And but what they, you know, what they're actually proposing, the implications it could have for radical social change is incredible, you know. So that's what struck me, is the power of what they're doing. If it was taken everywhere and multiplied, but, you know, things could really change. I think that's what Care to Planet are really, you know, they really see radical social change. In fact, any politicians that are really on the case with global warming issues and the environment and where we're going, they say the only way is radical social change, you know, And that is people completely changing their outlook.
Yeah.
And you can't change your outlook unless you change your home. You know, you've got to start at home. Charity starts at home, you know. And if you can change the way you live your own life, and everyone can try and change that, obviously with the help of architects and city planners, you know, we won't need to be so greedy and dependent, and maybe we will have a less stressful life, you know.
Now, staying with the environment, how do you feel about trees?
How do I feel about trees? I mean, trees are just the life source of the planet, really. It's like the sea and the fish. And I mean, Mike loves looking at... He asks... When people ask him, what do you think about... Where do you get your inspiration from? And he says, well, I don't generally get it from architects. I normally get it from trees or beavers or wasps or, you know, cockroaches or whatever. You know, animals... have and nature and trees have an amazing way of dealing and surviving, and I think trees are, you know, just the life source of, if we could be more like trees, then we'd have more chance, really. I mean, is that, I don't know. I mean, I'm into protecting. I mean, obviously we carbon balance the project with rainforest restoration projects. Yeah. A lot of these carbon balancing forestry projects you've got to be wary of, because a lot of them are going to happen anyway, and people are just cashing in on the carbon credits. And it's not, you know, what you need is carbon balancing companies that actually instigate projects, or are part of a team of other companies that instigate a project. A project would not have happened without their contribution to it. And the guy that I use actually goes out to Africa, and the rainforests wouldn't grow unless they're farmed. They've got to be farmed to a certain point, and then they'll be safe on their own. So you have to plant a different type of tree. It's a primary tree first.
Yeah.
That gives a protective environment for the rainforest to start regenerating, and then the local people can go in and cut those trees down, the primary trees, and use them for wood or whatever. And then the rainforest is on its own, and it can grow naturally. And it won't just happen on its own. It's been, those areas of Africa have been deforested for a long time now, and they're just kind of barren. And but they are capable of growing indigenous forests, but it needs mankind to help it along the first stage, and then it will recover forever. So we've contributed to that with the making of Garbage Warrior, to compensate for our 45 tons of carbon that was produced during the making of the film. So that was from beginning to our premiere at Toronto, including the flights to Toronto. So that's how we've dealt with it.
That's perfect. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Right. Congratulations on the film.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for the interview.
That was Oliver Hodge, director of The Garbage Warrior. Thanks for checking out the Green Chain Podcast, where we see the forest and the trees. For the Tai'i, I'm Mark Laren-Young.